Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The Islamic militant group Hamas was the surprise winner in last month's voting for the Palestinian parliament. Although dissatisfaction with the dominant party, Fatah, was widespread, apparently few people believed that Hamas would do so well. Now that the results are in, there are many questions about what they mean for Palestinian politics and certainly for relations between the Palestinian government and the Israeli government. This morning on Focus in this hour, we will explore this subject with Bishara Dumani. He is Associate Professor of History at the University of California at Berkeley. He specializes in the social and cultural history of the Palestinian people. Just a little bit more by way of background. He was born in Saudi Arabia. His father is Palestinian. He did some of his growing up in a suburb of Beirut, and then when he was a teenager, his family moved to the United States and settled in Ohio, and he was educated here in the United States. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions, as usual, are welcome. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief, and we ask that so that we can get in as many different people as possible, keep things moving along. But anybody who's listening is welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number to call. We do also have a toll-free line. That was good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and 800-222-WILL. Professor Dumani, hello.
Hello, David.
Thank you for talking with us. We appreciate
it.
Thank you. Just as a way of asking a very general question, there certainly, after the polling was in, a lot of people were talking about the result and asking the question, how is it, why is it that Hamas did so well, better than expected? How would you answer that question?
I would answer by saying that it was not really much of a surprise. The Palestinian press was full of reports at the time that there's two reasons why Hamas might do very well. One is the sort of implosion of Fatah, sort of the leading Palestinian political organization has dominated Palestinian politics since the 60s, split up just before the elections, fielded two different lists for candidates, and then at the last minute put them back together again, but a very weak list. And the other reason is that the way the election is organized, any voter would go in a booth and be handed two pieces of paper. One would be for political parties, which would take half the seats of the 132-member parliament, 66, and the other would be for the district candidates in the particular district that she lives in, for example, and another 66. What happened with Fatah is that they got 28 seats out of 66 for the national list, while Hamas got 29, so there's hardly any difference between them there. But when people voted on a district level, out of the 66, for example, each district was allotted a certain number of seats, let's say 6 seats for Jerusalem, well, Hamas fielded 6 candidates for the 6 seats, whereas Fatah fielded 10, 20, 50 candidates, and they just split up the vote among them, and therefore the Hamas list on a district level got about close to 50, 46 or so out of the 66, and which explains its dominance. There were press reports for the week or two before the election saying that this would happen. So it's not entirely a surprise.
Well, to what extent do you think that people were voting for Hamas in an affirmative way because they supported the principles and the program of Hamas? And to what extent was this a sign that people were just tired of Fatah and felt that Fatah had not done a good job to date, and they were simply interested in making a change and seeing if somebody else could do better?
I think that Hamas, I mean, that's hard to answer statistically, of course, because of the differences in the list. But it's clear that Hamas has a very strong popular base, maybe anywhere from 35% to 45% electorate. And they have consistently won student elections and other kinds of municipal and elections with that kind of a margin. So I think that's clear. But in this particular election, they got a lot more than 45%, and I think the rest of it can be explained as a vote against the occupation and against Fatah, which was seen as not able to protect its own people from the Israeli occupation. Hamas was seen as a group that will stand up to the Israelis and remind the world that this, in fact, is a country under occupation. And two, because of the corruption within Fatah itself, or at least its leading members, and Hamas was seen as a clean-cut organization that's not corrupt, that's able to keep its promises and deliver services, and they earned that reputation over two or more decades of putting together a really wide network of civil society-type organizations on a local level, which helped people out at a very difficult time, especially after the Oslo Accords were signed, when Palestinian society were really into an economic tailspin and poverty increased and unemployment increased tremendously. Hamas was able to come in and help people out, whereas the top leadership of Fatah was seen as sort of enjoying the benefits and the fruits of collaborating with Israel.
Let me ask you one further question, and then I have a couple of callers. I want to make sure that those folks know I will not make them wait too much longer. But I think that there was some criticism, has been some criticism of the analysis of the results, particularly in the Western mainstream press, along these lines, saying that it was all about what does this mean? What are the implications for relations between the Palestinians and the Israelis and the two governments? And perhaps not enough attention paid to the question of simply, as far as the Palestinians are concerned, what does the Hamas victory mean? So maybe let me ask you that, particularly as this is, you're interested in Palestinian social and cultural issues. What do you think that this means or that it will mean for Palestinians?
Well, I do appreciate that question. I think the first thing we have to remember is that it was important that elections were held. By any account, by any measure, this is said to be the cleanest and the most honest and transparent election ever held in the Middle East, including close to 80% participation. The chance that Palestinians, any chance that they have to basically be able to express themselves politically is good, because they rarely ever get that chance. Elections were not held since 1996, and before that, not in 1976. So that's only the third election in the last 30 years or so. The second thing is, I'm ambiguous about what effect this will have on Palestinian society. On the one hand, you can see an organization coming in that may be able to put together a national unity government that would finally represent the full political spectrum of the Palestinian people, and not just the one-color sort of spectrum, which is Fatah, that has dominated as a one-party state for so long. On the other hand, Hamas gained its strength through a long-term program of changing the social sort of culture of the Palestinians, shifting it from a more secular-based national movement to a more religious, at least in terms of language, national movement. And that has implications in terms of everything from personal status laws to educational material in school and so on. Now, Hamas has issued statement after statement saying there will be no major or abrupt changes in any of these things, that in fact they want to work on a joint political program and that they will not be putting out any sort of radical new laws, et cetera, et cetera. That remains to be seen.
All right. We have a couple of callers here. Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest, Bashar Dumani. He's professor of history, associate professor of history at University of California, Berkeley, and is particularly interested in the social and cultural history of the Palestinian people. We're talking here this morning about politics in the region and about the recent elections there. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have a couple of callers here, and I believe that they're both in Champaign. So we'll start with line number one. Hello.
Good morning, Professor.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Thank you.
Can I ask you a personal question?
A personal? It depends on the question, I think,
okay.
On the air. Go ahead.
What is your personal stance on the state of Israel's legitimacy?
You mean, what do you mean by legitimacy? You mean its right to exist?
See.
Si. Yes.
Yes, what?
Sorry?
Yes, what?
Professor Mann, you believe that Israel has a right to exist?
Oh, I believe that the Israeli people do exist, and they have a right to have their own state.
Well, that could mean it's in Europe.
It becomes a little bit more difficult to get more specific than that, because Israel is the only country in the world that has not recognized its own borders. So it's a question of what kind of Israel the caller has in mind. If it's the kind of Israel that's running on the platform of the Likud party right now for the elections in March, it means it's one that's against the Gaza withdrawal, against the Palestinian state. And if it means the Israel he has in mind for the Labor Party and their Amir Peretz, it means maybe withdrawal to the 67 lines, which is what the international consensus is, and that there will be a Palestinian state in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Or if it's the Israel he has in mind of the Kadima Party, which is the party founded by Sharon before he fell ill, it has a program of unilaterally imposing its borders without negotiating with the Palestinians, and that would include taking anywhere from 40 to 60% of the West Bank, which means that there will be no Palestinian state, that the Palestinians will live in basically concentration areas of the major cities, surrounded by barbed wire and checkpoints, and crisscrossed by Jew-only highways that they're not allowed to use, and that there will be no viable Palestinian society that can form a state. So it depends what the caller means. I endorse, of course, a two-state solution and the right of Israel and the Palestinians to have their own state, just like President Bush said. But then the question becomes, what kind of Israel is the caller talking about? I don't know.
Okay, just checking. The other question I had was, what is your stance on Hamas's lack of recognition for the state?
Yes, I think that the Hamas is under a tremendous pressure right now to live up to all the agreements that the Palestinian Authority has signed with the Israeli government and the international community. And that puts it in a very difficult position, because it basically ran on a platform of opposing many of these agreements, which they saw as a sellout of the Palestinians by the Palestinian Authority. So now, and I think legitimately so, people are saying, are you going to be running a government that is based on your long-term political program, or are you going to be running a government that has a different political program that takes into account the fact that the Palestinian Authority does exist and has already signed these agreements? In other words, Hamas is being asked, are you going to remain an organization devoted only to your own goals, remain like an IRA, for example, or are you going to sort of make a shift towards a Sinn Féin kind of political entity which will let go of one of its central tenets, which is resisting foreign military occupation by force, or and instead move into the political sphere? The elections are good because they allowed Hamas to participate in the political process, and our hope is this would reduce the level of violence. But that does not end the foreign military occupation of Palestinian lands, and as long as that occupation continues, it doesn't matter what the Palestinians vote in or out, because they have no sovereignty whatsoever. They have no control over their water, over their electricity, over their own physical movement from one place to the other, over their borders, over anything. So this election is taking place under military occupation, and I don't think we can forget that.
Can I ask one more question, and then I'll hang up?
Mm-hmm.
Sinn Féin and the IRA existed together. They didn't exist. I mean, they existed concurrently.
That's right.
Is it possible that Hamas will break into an armed wing and a political wing?
Well, not only is it possible, but it's already happened a while ago. There's always been a kind of a civilian leadership and an underground military leadership. And one of the things that I think allowed Hamas to win this election is that it was the only Palestinian political movement that was able to control its armed wing. If you remember, there was a lot of chaos in the Palestinian territories or those under control of the Palestinian Authority over the past year with armed militias of young people with guns doing this or that. They were almost in every situation, Fatah, not Hamas, people who were running around in the streets, taking over buildings and kidnapping and so on and so forth. And Hamas distinguished itself by basically sticking to what they call the ceasefire that they have with Israel, the Hudna, which since last February, but almost a year ago, started. And Hamas has issued statement after statement after the election saying that they are willing to continue this Hudna for another 20 years as long as the Israelis withdraw from Palestinian lands in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. So that remains to be seen, of course, whether this will happen or not. It also depends on what Israel does. There's been a lot of assassinations over the last 2-3 weeks in what some see as a deliberate attempt to provoke some sort of an armed confrontation, which of course Israel could easily win. So I'm hopeful that there will be no violence on either side. On the other hand, we have to prepare ourselves for that possibility.
Well, I appreciate the comments of the caller. Let's continue. We have, again, someone next holding on, also in Champaign. This is line number 2. Hello.
Good morning.
Yeah.
I have several questions, but let me break them up. The first relates to what you said about Hamas and its civil society functions and the improvements it made in areas where it has control. I've heard that, but I've also read reports in the media, newspapers, on the radio, talking of several issues. One was in the municipalities on the West Bank where Hamas has control. One election several years ago, that there was a sense by people who that they were losing their freedoms in terms of what they can drink, what they could watch, what sort of media they could be exposed to, how they can dress. This was especially so for secular and Christian Palestinians. So when it's the sense of that Hamas is trying to impose its view of Islamic law upon everyone in those municipalities, not only those who want to live by that rule. And this brings up all the issues of tolerance and intolerance, and especially given, as you were saying earlier, that Palestinian society had a more secular base in earlier years. And this also is followed up by reports that in Gaza, where as Hamas extends its control, there's been problems for people who have various businesses, such as a brewery, restaurants, and so forth. So there's that whole issue, the issue of problems in terms of women's rights, in terms of Christian rights, in terms of censorship, and in terms of control of the media. So I'd like to hear your response.
Sure, I would love to comment on that, and I thank you. Thank you for that question, because again, it focuses a little bit of time on the Palestinians themselves, as opposed to what other people are thinking. First, let me just make one quick correction. The municipal elections were not held several years ago; they were held fairly recently, actually, last year.
Okay.
Yeah, and. And I should say that in Christian areas such as Beit Lahem and Ramallah, the Hamas actually was supported by parties and groups that are Christian groups, because they were so sick and tired of Fatah.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a difficult situation maybe for some people to understand, but people are faced with either a municipality that doesn't work or a municipality that works but might come at the price of increased social discipline by one party.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of Nablus, for example, the Fatah candidate was absolutely not liked at all, was known as a very corrupt candidate, whereas the Hamas one was been a sort of a civil clean servant that everybody liked for like the last 30 years. in Nablus, nothing has happened at all, for example, in terms of any changes, stores that sold liquor before continued, and so on and so forth. But what has happened is that the European Union and the United States have cut off funds that they had promised earlier to this municipality for expanding the Najah University, for example, or a sewage program, and so on. And so people are being punished for electing a clean candidate by the international community by cutting off funding for projects that really affect everybody's life. So it's a very mixed picture here. I think people ought to appreciate that Palestinians have not had a chance to live a normal kind of life, and they really want that kind of normality because they live under occupation. They don't have much say about their daily life, and when they do, I don't think the world ought to punish them for it. Now, Hamas has in the past, especially in Gaza, when it was first rising after the first Intifada, tried to impose its presence on the street in a very strong and direct way by, for example, saying that women should veil in public. And there was a lot of resistance to that, but in my opinion, not enough resistance. So I'm very concerned that if Hamas stays in power for the next 5, 10, 15 years, that in fact we will see a lot of the same kind of movements on the personal status and educational and other fields that we see happening in many other countries. The question becomes for us here in this country is, do we have a right to decide who represents other people? And do we have a right to basically intervene on behalf of what we call liberal values, when in fact we are practicing a real double standard ourselves, in the sense that in terms of the occupation of Iraq and so on and so forth. So this is a very delicate kind of situation. I think overall it's good to have everybody represented in the political system, including Hamas, so these kinds of questions can be answered in a peaceful, nonviolent way through the ballot box and through government institutions and newspapers, as opposed to having anything sort of imposed from outside by force or even from the inside by force.
If I could just respond to that and then go on to something else. You brought up Nablus on the West Bank, but mm-hmm. the reports that I heard, and these were reports on the radio and in other media, were interviews with Palestinians on the West Bank in various municipalities. I don't remember if it was Nablus. I don't think so. Who were complaining specifically about the imposition by Hamas-run municipalities of various social restrictions, commercial restrictions, and so forth. And
yeah, they, I think if I mean, I think you, that was about Ramallah.
I don't remember. I think it was Beit something. I don't.
Oh, Beit Lahem and Ramallah are the.
No, it wasn't Beit Lahem. It was. Oh. It was another. It was. I can't.
I'm sorry, remember. I haven't heard those reports. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I. It was. In fact, one of the reports was on this station. On but I don't remember if it was NPR or if it was, or was the World. So I can't. Or even BBC. I can't.
Yeah.
Say that. But anyway, this is so obviously it's not something you've heard. Okay, let me switch to a different subject, and the subject is also the one you brought up, having to do with the leadership issues in Hamas and the conflicts that I've heard between leadership in Syria and other areas versus leadership in Gaza and West Bank, and issues in terms of their attitude towards some of the ongoing Palestinian-Israeli, whether we call it negotiations or we call it cooperations, in other words, areas where on the level below the top leadership there's ongoing coordination. So both of those, I'd like to hear you, if you have any thoughts and comments about that.
So are you talking about Hamas leadership or?
Well, first the issues had to do with Hamas leadership in mm-hmm. Syria versus Hamas leadership in Gaza or
right,
in West
right.
Bank. That's
right.
The first differences and how they work together or don't work together.
Yes, that's a good question. Hamas is not a monolithic organization, though. I must say that it has maintained an incredible discipline compared to other political organizations. So, for example, Fatah ran primaries before the elections that were a real farce, because there was a lot of cheating and there was a lot of mismanagement, and because several Fatah leaders who did not run in the primaries insisted that they should receive the top spots as if they had run. That gives you an idea. Whereas Hamas, I'm told, ran its primaries without anybody really knowing. They just got all its members, they voted, and it was clean, and they chose their candidates, and that was that, and there wasn't a big fuss about it. So having said that, though, it's true that the head of the political bureau of Hamas is in exile and based in Damascus, Khaled Mash'al, and that you have within Hamas in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip two major leaders, Akram Haniyeh and Sahar, who are seen as having a little bit of differences in terms of the hardness of their position vis-a-vis Israel and so on and so forth. And there is a healthy debate going on inside of Hamas all the time, but they don't really air out their dirty laundry in public much. So I don't think anybody can claim that to really know what's going on exactly on the level of the differences of leadership. But I think, judging from the statements that have been issued, if there is a moderate wing, certainly that's the one that's been in ascendance these days. And they're doing everything that they can to sort of convince other Palestinian political parties to work with them so they won't be alone. They're doing everything they can to say that there will be a ceasefire, for a long-term ceasefire, and no abrupt changes in the social field, and that they ask that the program of the Palestinian Authority will have to deal with Israel, even if it's not on a formal level. You are absolutely right. There's constant negotiations going on between Palestinians and the Israeli government about who gets a permit to move from one area to the other. Can the members of the parliament even convene? Will they be allowed to travel from Gaza to Ramallah, for example, where the parliament building is, et cetera, et cetera? And on those levels, Hamas, whether it likes it or not, has to get involved in those kinds of negotiations.
I'm going to jump in here. I hope the Gullah will forgive me. We've already used half our time and have a couple of other callers, and I do want to introduce again our guest for anyone who has just recently tuned in. In this part of Focus 580, we're talking with Bashar Domani. He is Associate Professor of History at the University of California at Berkeley. He's a scholar who specializes in the social and cultural history of the Palestinian people. We're talking about the recent Palestinian elections. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. We do have someone, obviously, listening on the internet. They are in San Francisco, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, greetings. I don't know if the professor's in his office, but it's funny how I call Chicago in order to talk across the bay. But I wanted to raise a couple of different things. Recently, St. Louis, about a year ago, they discovered that their water is owned by a German company. I'm wondering about the natural resources of the Middle East and how these constantly shifting boundaries are affecting the ability to get natural resources. So, for example, does water ownership transfer every time the new boundaries are laid out? And the other aspect I wanted to raise, I've been lucky enough to be listening to a little Lenny Bruce, a person that never gets enough radio exposure. And he had a shtick about Religion Incorporated. And I'm wondering if you've got any comments about how the abuse of the various religions. Lenny Bruce talked a lot about the Holy Land and how you could create an industry out of, you know, selling bits of olive leaves and this and that to the tourists. In fact, Mark Twain was talking about it 100 years ago. That it was Religion Incorporated. It had nothing to do with God anymore. It had much more to do with merchants in the temple, and whether or not the Holy Land is being used as an excuse for jockeying for position for the rubes, let's say, the suckers who believe that that God just owns a particular tiny little piece of land instead of the whole earth, and we shouldn't look at the big picture, but instead at a tiny little piece that's being portrayed as the Holy Land.
Well, you can reflect on that however you'd like, Professor DeMille.
Well, let me see. Water is really important, and it's the most important commodity in that area. And one of the really sad things is that the most of the water really collects in aquifers in the West Bank, and that's the Palestinian areas, but Israel controls at least 80% of that water, and it's not clear at all that regardless of who's in power, whether Palestinians will have access to that 80%. And right now, Israeli settlers who built homes on Palestinian lands live in communities with that use water at a much greater rate than their Palestinian neighbors can. And this has been a source of suffering for a lot of Palestinians. Their orchards are dying. Their water keeps getting cut off, whereas the settlers have, you know, grass lawns and swimming pools, and they're not even there legally. So this will remain, like many other issues, a really sore point, regardless of what happens in the elections, because until Palestinians have some kind of sovereignty over their own land, such as water or their airspace or their borders, etc., the problems that bring this conflict to the attention of the world will continue. Now, as far as religion and the Holy Land is concerned, I'm not sure I'm going to talk too much about that, but there is a real symbolic significance for Palestine. It's a land that's holy to the three major monotheistic religions, Islam, Christianity, and Judaism. And obviously, everybody has a stake in what happens there. Jerusalem, for example, is a city that the international community often has called for it to be internationalized, that it should not belong to any single group or religion, that it should be shared. And I think the Palestinian position has been Jerusalem should be the capital of Palestine, just as it can be the capital of Israel, but it the same time it should have free access for everybody to be there. In other words, it should be shared, and I think that's that would allay the fears of a lot of Christians, a lot of Muslims, a lot of Jews who want to be able to see a city that's free and not dominated by just one religion or one country. And that's important for everybody to understand that we are all part of you know, each other's dreams and lives. And Palestine especially so.
All right. Well, again, I hope the caller will forgive me for going on. We have a lot of other callers here. Let's go next to someone back here in Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. I wanted for you to comment on sort of an overarching phenomenon, it seems, of in the Arab world and other places, of a secular opposition being sort of decimated, leaving the fundamentalist as the only sort of place for opposition to prevail. And it's even worse in some places, particularly since Hamas was funded in its original days by Israel as sort of a opposition to the secular PLO, as it was at the time. And this is historical, and maybe history is bunk, but I think it's an important thing to bring up, and I'd like for you to comment on that.
Yeah, well, this is something that most Americans don't know about, but in fact, Islamic-type parties were not just funded by Israel, but by the United States and by many Arab regimes who felt in the 50s, 60s, and the early 70s that the biggest threat they faced towards their own dictatorship or their own policies was from a secular nationalist or sometimes leftist opposition. And this was in the context of the Cold War, of course, as well. And so Islamic or religious parties in general were seen as a counterweight. And I remember back in the early 80s when the secular nationalist Palestinians would go on demonstrations saying, you know, yes, yes to Palestine, yes, yes to PLO. There would be counter demonstrations by other Palestinians, say, down with Palestine, down with the PLO, because they were part of the Muslim Brothers, who later became Hamas, and who did not believe that there should be a secular Palestinian state, that Palestine was part of the Islamic community and should not become a state. And Israel, of course, supported them at that point. What's happened is that in a lot of these places, the chicken have come home to roost. The secular opposition was decimated from by oppressive state policies in Iran, in Syria, and many other Egypt, and many other places. People put in prison, tortured, killed. Their organizations dismantled, and they left the field really wide open for these Islamic parties. And so this is the historical background. But then I think we should also add that throughout the entire world, there seems to be a kind of a shift in political language from secular language to a religious language. We see here in this country anywhere from 40 to 60 million Americans being involved in evangelical and other types of religious movements that have a tremendous weight in terms of the policies of this country, whether they're in the government, being the core supporters of the Bush administration, or whether in terms of teaching intelligent design in school, and so on and so forth. And we see in Israel itself, of course, a very strong fundamentalist religious movement, many of them active among the settlers. And we see that in any other countries as well. So there seems to be a worldwide shift, of which the Middle East is only a part. So this means that, with especially after September 11, that these kinds of forces sort of feed on each other. Kind of a black and white world is what they're creating. And folks like myself, who specialize in the production of knowledge on academic higher educational level, well, we get paid to look at shades of gray and nuances and differences and make distinctions, and we're basically finding ourselves kind of irrelevant to the kind of world that's being built around us. And I think radio shows like this one that give you more than a 30-second soundbite that are really appreciated because they give people some in-depth knowledge of what's going on and allows them to make up their own mind based on information as opposed to just faith. Faith is important, but it's no substitute for knowledge.
If I might have one digression, something that bothers me about the coverage of the demonstrations about the caricatures of Muhammad is that they're called violent demonstrations, and of course there are. There have been some property damage and people attacked and this and that, but a lot of the deaths that are attributed to the demonstrators are actually the response of a repressive state regime that, the U.S. may or may not have something in propping up, and it just seems to me that to just say, look at the terribly violent demonstrations and not to see who the actors are. I mean, what kind of provocations could happen, et cetera, et cetera. But that is a digression, and I guess I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Well, thanks for the call. If I might, Professor Dumani, just ask one sort of quick, maybe not so quick, practical question, again, coming out of the election results. Hamas won a majority of the seats in the parliament now, 56% of the seats. And so now a new prime minister will have to be selected, and presumably this prime minister will be from Hamas. Mahmoud Abbas, the president, is from Fatah, and he has four more years in his term of office. He was elected in January of last year. So this raises this question of how does Hamas and whatever's left of the Fatah establishment and manage to, and whoever else is in the political mix here, all manage to come together and form a government?
Well, that's a $64,000 question, as they say. First of all, Mahmoud Abbas has three more years to go. His term is 4 years. He was elected a year ago. And Hamas really wants him to stay, and so does the United States and Israel and everyone else. So I think there's agreement on that. The question is, what kind of powers will he wield? If you read the article yesterday on the front page, the top article on the front page of the New York Times, it says that U.S. and Israel are discussing ways of toppling Hamas within 6 months. And part of that sort of what can only be considered kind of a public announcement of a coup has to do with starvation in terms of money. The Palestinian Authority, ever since Oslo, depends very much on international funders, and the issue here is to cut off these funds so that the salaries will not be able to be paid for the teachers, for the civil servants, and that the government will not be able to function, and that Mahmoud Abbas then will be able to, within 6 months, appoint a different government. And another tactic is to call in the parliament that had outgoing parliament into a special emergency session to change some of the basic laws to give Mahmoud Abbas new powers, which would allow him to dissolve any new parliament if he didn't like what they were doing. And that is not clear that will happen, but that is being discussed as well. Both of these steps, in my opinion, would be very counterproductive, and the people who will pay the price will not be the leaders of Hamas or leaders of Fatah, but the Palestinian population itself. And they're already in a very, very difficult situation as it is. I think it's much more productive to try to deal with the new realities as they have shown themselves on the ground right now, and give peace a chance.
Well, we'll try to get in a couple more callers here. We'll go next to someone in Urbana, line two.
Yes, I'm sorry that I missed the very beginning of the program, and you may have dealt with this, and I certainly appreciate the guest's extent of his knowledge and reasonableness. But the question is simply this. Despite the corruption within within Yafs Arafat's organization, Fatah, isn't it true that, that many Palestinians or most Palestinians reject the State of Israel and want to eliminate the State of Israel? Is that true?
No. In fact, what we have here is a situation very similar to the United States, in which the majority of the population wants one thing, but the governments are seized by minority groups that are pushing it in a different direction. So in the case of the Palestinians, poll after poll has shown that an overwhelming majority want a two-state solution, which is, of course, means not just a recognition of Israel, but a willingness to live side by side. The Palestinian parliament in 1988 in exile, that is to say, the one that represents all of Palestinians, and we shouldn't forget, by the way, that there's a lot more Palestinians out there than just the ones in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, the refugees and so on, also voted for a two-state solution after a lot of political debate and so on. So I think the Palestinians have both in terms of practice and in terms of consistency in public opinion showed that they very much want to have a two-state solution. And by the way, two-state solution means for the Palestinians that they get only 22% of their land.
Well, here's a question. Excuse me for interrupting.
Let me just finish. The same thing is true for the Israeli public. Poll after poll shows that the majority of Israelis also would like a two-state solution. So, but the Israeli governments that have been in charge haven't been in favor of that. We have a situation here where the governments and leadership are out of step with the population.
Yes, I'm sorry I interrupted you before, but the one thing is those settlements around Jerusalem and Tel Aviv that the Israeli government wants to keep will. Does the Palestinian conception of a two-state solution include all of the land to 67 and including those settlements? I mean, maybe it comes down to a question of borders.
Yeah, it's there's two ways to answer that question. One is to say what is the principled position, and two is to say what has come up in recent negotiations about this issue. In terms of a principled position, there's been an international consensus, at least ever since 1967, with the passage of Resolution 242 of the United Nations, which put together the formula of land for peace. That is to say, Israel withdraws from lands it militarily occupied in the 67 war in return for full recognition and peace with its neighbors. That has been at the heart of every single peace initiative that's ever been initiated since 1967 until today, and it's in the preamble of the Oslo Accords. So that means an Israeli withdrawal from Palestinian lands in the occupied East Jerusalem, West Bank, and the Gaza Strip. Now, facts have been created on the ground by the Israeli government in violation of international law, in which they're not allowed under the Geneva Convention to actually plant colonies in somebody else's land while they military occupy them. But the fact remains that they have done so, and they have done so in a way that is massive, that is to say, to build an infrastructure of highways, towns, universities, roads, checkpoints, etc., that have cost tens of billions of dollars with U.S. help. And that has changed the very landscape itself, and people rightly say, well, can this ever be rolled back? Shouldn't they agree on something that will accept the fact, even though it's illegal that they're there, and try to find some other way to compensate them? So there's been conversation going on about, well, maybe you get to keep this part of the West Bank that you took illegally, but we get to, for example, be compensated by land in another area that can be annexed to Palestinian state. And so there's been all sorts of initiatives about some sort of land swaps that are going on, but none of that has even come close to a level of agreement. So I don't want to say what the future technical sort of solution to this issue ought to be, but as a matter of international law and principle and international consensus, of which only two countries oppose, that's the United States and Israel, there should be a full return to the 67 borders.
Yeah. Why doesn't Hamas change the language to accept the state of Israel?
Yes, I think that this is going to be an issue that they will have to deal with. The PLO eventually ended up changing the language of its charter, and Hamas might well have to do the same thing. It's important to pay attention to language. I think language is very important. At the same time, it's also a very good idea to pay attention to what people do. And in this case, we should watch very closely what both Israel and Hamas do as they sort of play this game of how to shape the politics of the next 3 to 5 years.
It just, again, I hope the caller forgive me for jumping in, though. It seems that you can't underestimate just how difficult this particular issue, that is the drawing of the borders issue, and then there are a couple of others. One that you touched on has to do with Jerusalem, and then there's another issue, a third issue that's been very contentious, and that's the right of return. And that all of these things are extremely difficult, and they're going to take a long time, and both all of the parties are going to have to be willing to give up something in order to get something, and it seems that in the past that's been difficult.
And I'll tell you why. People forget that there's a real imbalance of power here. You have a country, Israel, which is the sixth strongest military in the world, and a decimated Palestinian population that's living in abject poverty right now. So you have a first world country in terms of income, as you know, a leader in terms of military power. And it's like a contest between a truck and a bicycle coming at each other at full speed. So when people forget that, and forget that the Palestinians are living under foreign military occupation, they tend to think, well, why can't they just be reasonable with each other and talk to each other and decide rationally? The fact is that Israel has imposed its will on the Palestinians in a very violent and arbitrary way to basically define for itself the borders of Israel right now, which we see happening through the creation of what they call the separation fence, barrier, or wall, depending on what language you use. But the point is that you have now Palestinian communities that are entirely surrounded by high walls and machine gun turrets at the top, and they are allowed out of their city or out of their town 1/2 hour in the morning, and allowed to come in 1/2 hour in the evening. And if they miss that half hour, they don't get into town or they don't get out of town. That's the situation on the ground. And so there's only so much that the Palestinians can do in this kind of situation to say, well, we give up on this and we give up on that, but at some point they have to get something but they can't force anyone to give them that something. That has to be done through the help of the international community and through the Israeli public itself, finally electing a government that represents the majority opinion. If you remember, the Oslo Accords were a moment of hope back in 1993 when they were signed on the Western lawn of the White House. But Rabin, who was a leader of Israel, was assassinated by a right-wing Jewish Israeli citizen for signing that accord. And every single leader that has come into the Israeli government after that, whether it's Netanyahu or Sharon or Barak, are people who voted against the Oslo Accords or were against the Oslo Accords. So what the Palestinians are faced with a rejectionist Israeli government, and one that controls their lives. And so you can imagine the frustration that's been welling up, because the whole time that people have been talking about peace, on the ground something else has been going on. More Palestinian homes have been demolished in the last, since Oslo Accords, than ever before. More Palestinian lands have been grabbed since Oslo than ever before. More Israeli settlements have been built on Palestinian lands since Oslo than ever before. And the economic situation has completely deteriorated, because a lack of freedom of movement means that people can't run businesses, they can't run institutions. There's high-level unemployment, extreme poverty. And in fact, many Palestinians who can afford to or can get out have gotten out. There's been at least anywhere from 150 to 300,000 Palestinians who basically had to leave in order to provide for their families. And this is an intolerable situation. It cannot go on forever. And the United Nations has repeatedly warned that Palestinian society is facing imminent collapse if that situation goes on. And this will only lead to much more extreme situations than we have now in terms of who represents the Palestinians, who speaks for them, because they really, in the end, may not have anything to lose.
We're going to have to stop. We're here at the end of the time. I promise we will continue to have conversations on the subject with other guests on other days. But for now, we're going to have to say thanks to our guest, Bashar Damani. He is an associate professor of history at University of California, Berkeley. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.